Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Robert Morgan, the chair of the NCCN Guidelines Committee on Ovarian Cancer, to obtain a better feel for how he incorporates research evidence into practice, and I asked Dr. Morgan to present several patients from his practice, and he began by commenting on a woman who sought out a consultation after having a laparotomy for optimally debulked ovarian cancer.
The first patient that I picked out was a 53-year-old lady who presented with pelvic pain right at the time of her menopause. She initially saw her doctor. It was looked into a little bit, but then the pain persisted, and ultimately she received an ultrasound revealing pelvic masses. She had basically a biopsy surgery in Mexico, where she was living at the time, that included a right salpingo-oophorectomy and an omental biopsy. She had a high-grade endometrioid cancer and then came to the United States, where she was seen and evaluated by gynecologic oncology, and she received a completion debulking surgery, which included a sigmoid colon resection, nodal dissection, both periaortic and pelvic nodes, a completion hysterectomy, and an omentectomy, and she had optimal tumor debulking. So if a patient's able to be optimally debulked, I'm a proponent of doing intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and I always try via the Armstrong regimen. I'm a little bit of a slave to the literature, although I know that nationally some people are using different or modified Armstrong regimen in order to make it more tolerable or more logistically possible.
So when you met with her at that point after surgery, aside from the Armstrong regimen, which of course is 6 21-day cycles of paclitaxel IV day one, cisplatin IP day two, and paclitaxel IP day eight, what other options did you discuss with her?
When I see these patients, I'll go through the various options. I will often copy the NCCN guidelines. And this lady, while she was Spanish-speaking, also spoke relatively good English, and she has family members that spoke excellent English, probably better than me. And so there was no real problem with communication with she or her family. Prior to her surgery, though, we had discussed the option of the GOG 252 trial and went through the various arms, and which one of those arms was intravenous chemotherapy alone. But I also discussed standard therapies with the patient, which is my usual pattern.
So I know she ended up actually going on the study. What does it actually randomize patients between?
The randomization is between standard IV chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. There's a second arm that is a modified Armstrong regimen with a slightly decreased cisplatin dose to 75 milligrams per meter squared rather than the 100 milligrams per meter squared that was published by Dr. Armstrong in 2006. And the third arm is a intravenous and intraperitoneal chemotherapy with intraperitoneal carboplatin. All of the arms, however, receive bevacizumab as part of the regimen.
And just out of curiosity, if she was not eligible for the trial or didn't want to participate, what would have been your primary recommendation?
My primary recommendation is still the published literature, which is the Armstrong regimen.
And that would be without Bev?
That would be without Bev, correct.
So what happened with this lady, and what was her thinking in entering the trial, incidentally? Was she, was it more altruistic, or do you have any feeling for why she decided to go in it?
Interestingly enough, everyone seems to go on clinical trials for different reasons whenever I talk to people. Interestingly enough, in this particular situation, one of the major reasons the patient, and I think it was more her family, was kind of twisting her arm a little bit, although she ultimately had to make the decision, was that they were pretty convinced that bevacizumab was active and they wanted bevacizumab as part of her regimen.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Certainly bevacizumab has got a lot of attention in a lot of different tumors. But, when you think about this study too, I always thought to myself, getting randomized between intraperitoneal and IV is a pretty different route in terms of maybe quality of life.
Actually, it is in quality of life during the treatment, particularly with cisplatin, the quality of life is worse on the intraperitoneal chemotherapy, at least cisplatin when 100 milligrams per meter squared is the dose. However, at 12 months, the quality of life was compared, and that data has been published, and the quality of life in the intravenous versus the intraperitoneal patients is equivalent. And so there isn't really any worsening of long-term toxicity. What I normally say is that they're going to have increased toxicity, particularly nausea and vomiting and some myelosuppression. But on the Armstrong regimen paper that was published in New England Journal of Medicine in 2006, one of the major reasons for patients to be stopping the treatment on that arm was portacath failures. And I think that that is more a function of the ability, this is one man's opinion now, but I think it's the function of the ability of the physicians that are putting the portacaths in, as well as the nursing staff, probably the nursing staff is even more important, on how to care for those, because we don't see a 40% incidence of portacath failures where I practice. Our failure incidence may be 10%. And I think it's a matter of the nurses being so familiar with how these are managed that keeps the portacaths functional.
Any other pearls about clinical management? I know one of the things you've talked to me in the past about is hydration.
Correct. And in fact, my nurse practitioner a few years ago when we started using this regimen realized that these patients, particularly after the day one, day two chemotherapy regimen, would feel much better with daily intravenous hydration. We send them home for the first week and have a liter of fluid each day given intravenously. And these patients do much better with good IV hydration.
So agree or disagree, this lady had been treated in the community, she probably would not have gotten IP therapy.
I'm guessing that she probably would have received intravenous chemotherapy on the Q3-week basis. However, there's many physicians in the GYN oncology world that were participating in GOG 252, so she very well may have been randomized to one of the IP arms.
So what actually happened with this lady?
This lady was randomized to an intraperitoneal arm using intraperitoneal carboplatin, intravenous cis-paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. And so she actually received all six cycles of chemotherapy on study. She tolerated it well. At the end of the study, interestingly enough, though, the post-treatment CT scan revealed that she had a ovarian vein thrombosis. And what to do with that thrombosis was unclear because she was also randomized to the 12-month maintenance bevacizumab arm. And so we had a lot of discussion amongst my department as to whether we would require anticoagulation for an ovarian vein thrombosis. Ultimately, because we were going to continue or hoped to continue the bevacizumab, we did elect to anticoagulate her for 6 months. The ovarian vein thrombosis did not completely resolve, but it did shrink. And at the end of 6 months, we assumed that it was probably well adherent to the vessel wall. There's quite a bit of controversy as to whether one needs to anticoagulate an ovarian vein thrombosis in any event.
I kind of wonder what the pathophysiology would be. I mean, would you think there's a connection to the Bev here?
I can't rule it out because thrombosis is one of the major side effects of bevacizumab therapy, so I can't rule it out. On the other hand, ovarian vein thromboses often occur in patients post-hysterectomy and post-oophorectomy, so it's hard really to know for sure whether it was causal.
So what's this lady's current situation, and how did she do with the treatment?
She basically tolerated the treatments very well. Her main toxicity was fatigue primarily. Other than that, I really did not have much problem getting her through all of her therapies.
What about hypertension?
She had a little bit of hypertension, and we had to put her on some antihypertensive medication near the end of the bevacizumab. But again, it was easily controlled.
Anything else you want to say about her case?
I think that one must be aggressive and take the time to discuss these research interventions, even in patients who may be Spanish-speaking or have a different language, because otherwise I think that we need to offer research interventions to all of the groups of patients that we care for in the United States. And in this patient, it did take, you know, a couple of hours probably by the time we finished explaining all of the details of the study to she and her family, and our protocol nurse really was very helpful in this situation.
So just out of curiosity, sort of bread and butter type question, I'm sure you deal with this in the NCCN guidelines. What is her follow-up plan specifically?
The follow-up plans on the clinical trial are that she needs to be seen every 3 months. We do follow markers, CA125. And I believe that the study requires a repeat CT scan every 6 months.
And would that be what you would do in your own practice outside of trial?
Actually, that's a little more aggressive than I generally do. The Rustin trial from England suggested that CA125s in asymptomatic individuals really did not help in long-term outcomes in the patients. However, most of the patients, when we talk to them, really do want to have the CA125 level. I think both patients and probably me too have gotten a little bit addicted to CA125 levels, although sometimes they just make both of us more nervous than really help with long-term decision-making. Nonetheless, if patients do have a rising CA125, sometimes that will lead us to doing a repeat CT scan. Sometimes, particularly in patients with low-volume disease, I think going in early with treatment, particularly if you're going to do secondary debulking surgeries, may be more beneficial than waiting until the CA125 is really high and or the patient has intra-abdominal symptoms. So I think those are some of the things that need to be worked out on whether or not CA125 should be routinely followed.
So I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball maybe 5 years from now. I'm not sure exactly how long it's going to take for this trial to really be able to report. Maybe you can tell me that. And maybe make some guesses about what it might show and how it's going to be interpreted, particularly because everybody gets bevacizumab.
I think the most, and what I'm waiting for, and I think we're going to get preliminary data within 12 to 24 months. I really don't think we're going to have to wait 5 years for this. The data that I'm looking for is the data on equivalence of carboplatin and cisplatin given intraperitoneally. I believe this is, again, this is me looking into a crystal ball like you just asked me to do. I believe that the IP arms are going to continue to show an advantage over the intravenous arm, which we've seen on previous trials. I also believe that carboplatin intraperitoneally is going to be shown to be equivalent with less toxicity than cisplatin, and I can't wait for that data to come out so that we can hopefully put cisplatin away again, which we did back in 1992 or so.
I mean, that really is going to be important in terms of patient care. But I also wonder, again, what is it going to mean in terms of Bev? Because I kind of get the feeling that a lot, if not most, investigators like you in this situation would not use Bev right now in this situation off study, and yet everybody in the trial is getting it.
Again, since all three arms received the bevacizumab, I don't think that you're going to necessarily need to discount the data regarding the differences in the intraperitoneal arms. Now, what happens if the bevacizumab causes the intravenous arm to be equivalent to the intraperitoneal arms? I think that that's going to be the conundrum. I think that's unlikely.
Any comments on the use of bevacizumab in relapse disease? At ASCO, we saw data from the phase 3 OCEANS trial demonstrating some impressive benefits of adding Bev to chemo.
That data suggested that there was a progression-free survival in patients who received bevacizumab in addition to combination chemotherapy and recurrent ovarian cancer. The important part of that that really did fascinate me is the fact that there was a substantial improvement in response rate. There was a 20% improvement in response rate in the arm of patients that received bevacizumab in addition to carboplatin and gemcitabine compared to the chemotherapy alone. And many times, particularly in the recurrent setting, you're not just looking necessarily for a survival benefit, but you're also looking to palliate patients, make them feel better, try to get them into a remission that will last longer. And many times response rate will be a form of that type of indication. Now, I know there's many very well-known ovarian cancer doctors who realize, including myself, that ovarian cancer is very difficult sometimes to assess response rate, but in the OCEANS trial, I think measurable disease was one of the requirements on the study. So this wasn't simply CA125 results. This was, in fact, responses by RECIST criteria.
So let's talk about your 47-year-old lady.
This is a very interesting patient also because she felt about 4 years ago that she had an umbilical hernia, and that was her only symptom. So the surgeon that she consulted went in to do an elective hernia repair, and she was found to have a papillary serous carcinoma on the hernia sac. At that point, she was referred to a gynecologic oncologist where she had completion debulking surgery, much as we mentioned before, and she had stage 3C papillary serous carcinoma. Postoperatively, she was treated with chemotherapy on the Armstrong regimen, with normalization of her CA125 from 3,000 pre-op to 1,000 to 3 post-chemotherapy. Now, I don't know if this was done. This was not done in our institution, and I don't know if she was on study. I do not think she was. But then following the initial treatment, she was offered and was treated with pazopanib on a GOG maintenance trial, and she received pazopanib for a year. She was offered a second year, and she declined. She then came to see me because the physician at her institution had moved on and she wanted a different institution. So she came to see me and she was really asymptomatic except for kind of mild groin discomfort. She had an enlarged lymph node, but it had been there, she said, for at least 6 months. So we elected to watch it. Her CA125 was normal. Over the course of the next 6 months, her CA125 went up and ultimately a CT scan revealed some new liver lesions. And ultimately, the groin node was biopsied, and it was found to be recurrent carcinoma. She then went on for an attempt at debulking surgery, but interestingly enough, our CT scan did not reveal that she had intrathoracic disease, but at the time of surgery, she was found to have intrathoracic disease, and she was felt to be unresectable because the tumor extended to the pericardium. A thoracic surgeon was consulted intraoperatively. Postoperatively, she's received chemotherapy now on a clinical trial utilizing a PARP inhibitor. She is BRCA positive, and she's had a marked CA125 response and also a CT scan response following two cycles of chemotherapy. And again, she's tolerating the therapy quite well, except for some myelosuppression.
And does she have any family history of breast or ovarian cancer?
No.
What's the incidence of BRCA positivity overall in patients like this with ovarian cancer?
There's some data coming out now that suggests that particularly young patients, now she's 47, but particularly patients who are below the age of 40, that there can be an incidence. I think I've read some of the data suggesting even up to 15% of BRCA positivity in just a unselected group.
And she's BRCA 1 or 2?
She's BRCA 1.
Anything that you, I guess, in this situation, you're not thinking about anything special with her breasts other than screening?
We screen her routinely. Our clinical geneticists in patients who are BRCA positive recommend a 6-month evaluation of breasts with alternating MRI and mammogram.
And I'm curious how she did on this PARP inhibitor. This is the ABT888 compound. I guess it's kind of hard to separate out what might be side effects from the chemo, the carboplatin, or not, but any sense whether or not the PARP inhibitor is adding any toxicity?
This lady had an interesting pattern because we gave her first cycle of chemotherapy with the PARP inhibitor, carboplatin, and paclitaxel, and she had no toxicity except for mild nausea and vomiting, which was easily helped with anti-nausea medication. The second cycle, however, her ANC decreased to 600, and that did not recover for 3 weeks. I did not treat her with growth factor with the second cycle because her initial cycle, growth factor wasn't allowed on the study. And with the first cycle, she had no hematologic toxicity, but with the second cycle, she did. And I can't help but think that it's at least partially due to the ABT888 since that's the primary toxicity of that class of drugs. Her white count with the help of a little bit of Neupogen did recover over 3 weeks, and we're retreating her. We had to get some permission from our IRB because of the delay in her count recovery.
What's new in terms of PARP inhibitors? It kind of seems like over the last few years that there's been more encouraging data coming out in ovarian cancer than in breast cancer, where it's kind of lost a lot of steam. Where are we right now with ovarian cancer and PARP inhibitors?
Unfortunately, we're still having lost steam, although I think that there's still promise. Olaparib has been shown to have an improved progression-free survival in patients when it's used in treatment of ovarian cancer. I don't believe, but I could be wrong, that there are any requests pending, though, for approval of the drug, as there's no randomized phase 3 studies at the present time.
Now, you mentioned that this lady, prior to coming to you, had been on the TKI pazopanib. First of all, just, I don't know, when talking to her, how did she do while she was on it? Some of these TKIs can be a little problematic.
She really didn't complain much about side effects. I'm not real sure why she didn't accept the second year of maintenance, except for the fact that I think she was just tired of being treated at that point.
Anything new in terms of pazopanib? And for that matter, are there other TKIs that seem kind of similar, cedirinib and the BIBF-1120 compound?
Well, they all are primarily, in my opinion, VEGF inhibitors, although pazopanib is a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It looks at c-KIT and PDGFR also. But I think that clinically, we're still waiting for one to be shown to be necessarily better than another. Bevacizumab is still the prototype anti-VEGF inhibitor, clearly has activity in ovarian cancer, clearly is tolerated, clearly has its own set amount of toxicities that seem to be class-specific toxicity. And that includes pazopanib has the same type of class-specific toxicity, although there's some hint that there may be less thrombotic complications, but I don't think that's been shown in any randomized fashion.
So as you sort of look in this lady's future, and hopefully she'll stay in remission for a long period of time, but if she were to develop progressive disease, what might you be thinking about both on and off study?
Well, off study, I think that even if this patient doesn't develop progressive disease, the question will be after we've treated her with, which is kind of the standard six cycles of chemotherapy, where do we go from there? And I think if she has a CT scan that is completely clean and a CA125, basically a complete response based on criteria, standard approach would likely be observation. At the present time, for second line, there isn't really a good maintenance trial available out there to me, so I would likely observe her. I think that on study, I think we need better maintenance drugs, and what I would really like to see in clinical trials is I would like to see a pure bevacizumab maintenance trial designed and carried out, because I think that that drug is going to show better long-term efficacy in patients in the maintenance setting than it is in the upfront or in combination with chemotherapy setting.
So let's talk about your last patient, the 49-year-old woman.
This is a lady who actually I'm currently treating, and she had dysmenorrhea about May of last year with some increasing and abnormal vaginal spotting that was going through her periods. And in early January, an ultrasound was finally done, revealing an ovarian mass. She then, however, went to an emergency room with abdominal pain and rebound tenderness and was felt to have appendicitis, and actually went to surgery on January 20th, underwent a THBSO, omentectomy, pelvic and periaortic lymph node dissection. She was treated by a gynecologic oncologist. She also had resection of the tumor under the diaphragm, and at that time had a grade 1 on the outside pathology report, endometrioid adenocarcinoma, but it did have a clear cell component, and she had a gross total resection. She postoperatively developed pulmonary emboli and was placed on anticoagulation, and then was referred to me, where our pathology review revised the report to a grade 3 endometrioid adenocarcinoma based on nuclear atypia and high Ki-67 staining. Her stage was considered 3B. We offered her chemotherapy on the Armstrong regimen and gave her an initial cycle, but she had very, very poor tolerance to the first cycle of intraperitoneal cisplatin. The second cycle, I switched her to intraperitoneal carboplatin, much like the second arm on the GOG-252 trial. And unfortunately, she developed transient transaminitis. Following cycle 4, she developed adhesive bowel obstruction, and we had some trouble clearing that. And so for the last cycles of chemotherapy, she's receiving intravenous carboplatin and paclitaxel to complete her six cycles of chemotherapy. In general, she's doing okay now, but she has had a bit of a rocky course through her chemotherapy.
What would you say are kind of the teaching points that come out of this case?
I think that the major teaching point, again, has to do with the cisplatin. Not everybody's going to tolerate your cisplatin. And I think that the physicians, if you're going to try cisplatin up front, have to be relatively okay with changing the regimen if the patients aren't tolerating the chemotherapy and if they're having difficulty staying hydrated, if they're just plain having intolerance, because it's important to get the entire course of therapy through. And patients that are intolerant of the drugs up front likely aren't going to be able to tolerate six cycles of chemotherapy. And I think it's important that they get six cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy.
So just kind of taking a step back, I'm kind of curious what some of the common questions are that you get from oncologists in practice or from your fellows about ovarian cancer management?
The main questions, I think, that are coming out, particularly in the teaching, is do we need to do intraperitoneal chemotherapy? Why do we need to do it? And I always will go through the three major randomized trials starting out back in 1995. Dr. Alberts published an initial trial looking at cisplatin IP or IV with intravenous cyclophosphamide, showing a decreased toxicity, interestingly enough, on the IP arm with an improved survival. Problem back in those days was that paclitaxel came out shortly thereafter and replaced cyclophosphamide. That remains, though, the only randomized IP versus IV trial that compares dose equivalent drugs, IV to IP, that showed an improvement in the IP arm. And then, of course, the second trial is Dr. Markman's trial that was published in the early 2000s. Unfortunately, that one had only borderline p-values for a number of reasons, and it was asking a number of questions, including the ability of dose-dense carboplatin to improve long-term outcomes. So it wasn't strictly an IP versus IV study. Nonetheless, there was a significant p-value to the IP arm, but there was a lot of myelosuppression that was attributed to the IV high-dose carbo. And then the third study, of course, is the Armstrong regimen that was published in New England Journal of Medicine in 2006. So those are the major questions, really, that my fellows come up with. But I always try to remind them that it does take very intensive supportive care to get them through those regimens. Then the second thing, of course, particularly with the new data coming out, is the role of VEGF inhibitors and bevacizumab and whether we should be treating upfront versus we should just be using maintenance bevacizumab. And should we put patients on bevacizumab after their initial treatment, even if we didn't use it upfront? Because that's, of course, the missing arm in the GOG-218 trial, is the chemotherapy with placebo followed by maintenance bevacizumab. And that arm wasn't there. And I think that's the arm that a lot of us wish were there, because it would have tried to answer the question as to whether bevacizumab alone is going to be effective as a maintenance drug. But that's one of the things that the fellows ask. The referring doctors will call me up, and I'll always tell them that I tend to be a slave to the literature, probably more so than I should be, but I always try to use the published data in a non-study situation. So we still do use the 24-hour infusion of paclitaxel, which was part of the Armstrong regimen, although many people, including the newer GOG studies, are using the 3-hour infusion of paclitaxel as the paclitaxel arm.
Well, I guess a slave to the evidence is the right kind of person to be running the NCCN committee, I guess, huh?
We get discussions during the committee.
Anything new? I haven't seen much in terms of discussions of immune-based therapy for ovarian cancer. We see, particularly in melanoma and other tumors, even lung cancer now, some interesting things coming out. Anything happening in terms of ovarian cancer and immune therapy?
We are actually likely, it's early discussions, but I think we're likely to participate in a trial that is looking at T-cell-based immunotherapy, looking at patients that have NY-ESO expression on their ovarian cancer, which is around 20 or 30% of ovarian cancer patients. The study is designed to manipulate T-cells in vitro and then reinfuse in vivo in patients who have had moderately myelosuppressive chemotherapy followed by the infusion of the T-cells. And again, the idea is to try to use cell-based immunotherapy to elicit responses. Now, some of these studies have been done, I think, very preliminarily, and I think this is cutting edge because immunotherapies are now coming out as a good, particularly what you mentioned in melanomas, as a new potential treatment approach that has not really been exploited well in the last 15 or 20 years.
So just to be a little controversial, I'll ask you, agree or disagree with this statement? There's really not much going on in ovarian cancer clinical research, and we're likely to be in the same exact position 5 years from now.
Disagree, okay? I'll disagree, but I'm not going to strongly disagree. I think that we are making stepwise progress in the last 15 or 20 years. I think we've made stepwise progress. I clearly think we've made progress. Unfortunately, I don't see anything that is a major change coming in the next 5 years. But I think we're going to continue to make stepwise progress. And I think we're going to have new agents coming out that are demonstrated to be active. I think the immunotherapy types of approaches have definite promise. And I think that they're going to be shown to be active. But in 5 years, we're not going to have a randomized trial, obviously, showing that. And that's the reason I can't strongly disagree with your assertion.
So last question, ovarian cancer screening. I see you've got this paper, Thinking Outside the Box About Screening for Ovarian Cancer, The Nose Knows. I like that title. What are your thoughts about it?
Unfortunately, ovarian cancer screening in the general population or even in the high-risk population at the present time, using our current blood tests, which are CA125 or HE4, given done in concert with endovaginal ultrasounds, has not yet proven that we can identify a group of patients that needs to have surgery in order to improve their long-term outcomes. So screening's been a bit of a failure, primarily because I think the incidence is so low. Now, interestingly enough, Dr. Horvath, the paper to which you refer is actually referring to three papers that have been published by Dr. Horvath in Sweden. And what he's demonstrated is that there are some type of volatile chemicals which seem to be emanated by the cancers. And he first trained a dog, which has exquisitely sensitive smelling apparatus, to identify and show the difference between ovarian cancer and non-malignant tissue. And the dog was almost 100% sensitive in vitro, smelling tissues in petri dishes. The only one he got wrong was actually an endometrial cancer rather than an ovarian cancer, but it was still malignant. So then what he tried to do was see, well, could we do this in blood? And he looked at blood samples. And so this volatility seems to occur in blood samples also. And so the issue is, the problem is that it's hard to deal with animals. And I think that no one's yet taken on the idea of living dogs as screening mechanisms. I asked one of my colleagues when I was asked to review one of these papers, and she looked at me and said, so when I go to my gynecologist, I'm going to have a dog scan instead of a CAT scan? Well, the next thing is so they said, well, maybe we'll try to do an electronic nose. And under the current technology, the nose was much less accurate than the dog was at identifying the malignant tissues. So at the present time, man or woman's best friend is still a more sensitive idea. I'm not a dog person, essentially. I think I'd like to see a dog person maybe try to figure out how to take biological animals and try to see if we can fix it. They certainly do sniff out drugs at airports and sniff out guns and stuff at airports. It would be nice if they could sniff out ovarian cancer and diagnose it earlier. We'll see what happens.
I got to say, I like the creativity there. You know, I find that at least it's a little bit different.
I agree with you, and that's why I think Dr. Horvath has a very ingenious way of early identification.